Geeks, Freaks, and Tomb Dwellers, and welcome to episode 94 of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before we kick off this episode, just a couple things. Number one, I have now made it into round four of the Next Up music contest. Believe me, I really didn't expect to make it this far, and I know I keep saying that, but this time I really didn't. But I'm still going strong in this competition. There are three rounds left after this, I believe. Finalist voting round, then the semifinals, and the final round. I'm really not expecting to make it past this round, but like I said, we'll see what happens. Because I didn't expect to make it this far, and I'm quite shocked that I have, to be quite honest. But anyway, thank you once again to everyone that has voted for me. I really appreciate it. And this will be the last new episode for the next 2 weeks, as I'll be going on a two-week hiatus for vacation. These last 8 months have really kind of taken a toll on me mentally and physically, with my accident and work and some things that have been going on in my personal life. And so this is a much needed vacation that will be coming up next weekend. So like I said, I will be on hiatus for the next 2 weeks. But I will be returning the first week of August with a brand new episode. Also, the debut single of my side project with part-time co-host and friend of the show, Jerry Hartman, Starship Poopers, We Are the Starship Poopers, has finally seen the light of day, and it is now available on Spotify, Deezer, YouTube, Apple Music, iTunes, blah, 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 all the usual suspects. It's a little bit different from what I do in Raped by Wolves, which I did purposely, but and it's a little odd, to say the least, because it's me and Jerry doing it. But I do all the electronics and programming and provide secondary vocals. And Jerry does vocals and the lyrics. So if you haven't checked that out yet, it's available now. So if you'd listen to it, we'd really appreciate it. Alright, so to get into the episode proper, today I thought I'd talk about some movies that have made even me say what the fuck when I was after I was done watching them, because either the material it dealt with was disturbing, or there were some scenes in the movie that were rather disturbing. And as you've probably come to know, just from listening to this podcast, I'll pretty much watch any horror movie, even if it's really bad, as I've talked about in a lot of these episodes. So it's really hard to shock or surprise me when it comes to horror movies, but the ones I'm going to talk about in this episode have. So let's get right into it with 2007's Exhibit A.
I'm Judith. And this is my camera. This is my bed. And that's where I sit. I can see your garden clearly from here. I've been watching you since you moved in 2 months ago. Now I can film you too.
You've met my brother. He's very annoying.
Oh, there's my mom.
She's trying to buy a new house by the sea that she's fallen in love with.
How do you two feel about living in a house like this?
That's my dad.
I am not the only one with secrets.
He'd do anything for me, my dad.
Shh, be quiet. So, your fun's over.
Freeze! Get up!
I just want to show you some filming that I've been doing.
Freeze!
I don't understand what's going on anymore, Dad. I'm going to find out.
Will you stop being frightened of me?
The movie opens with the disclaimer from, I forget the name of the town, but they're the town's police department saying that this video footage was found at the scene of a murder. At the scene of a murder site on the daughter's video camera. We then cut to the King family, which consists of Judy, her father Andy, mother Sheila, and brother Joe in the United Kingdom. Judith uses a video camera gifted to her to document her troubles. She's gay and has not yet come out to her family, and she has a crush on Claire, a teenage girl across the street. Judith often spies on Claire and films her from the bedroom window. On a trip to see their new house, Judith tries to convince Andy not to make the family move away, but is unable to tell him about her crush on Claire. Andy is chasing a promotion at work, but financial strain and familial pressure causes him to behave erratically. One night, Andy comes home covered in blood and claims that his work colleague Ray has suffered a facial injury. It appears likely that Andy is not going to get the promotion, nor be able to sell the house, and this causes him further mental distress. Sheila and Joe begin to frequently argue with Andy, and then one night, Judith hides in the garden, and Andy tries to grab her, but she screams and runs back inside, locking the door behind her in her bedroom. Andy then impulsively builds a new swimming pool, and the Kings hold a pool party during their open house. A disfigured Ray shows up and invited, gets angry, and nearly attacks Andy, who escorts him outside. Judith secretly films their confrontation, and Ray blames Andy for his injury and accuses him of trying to steal his job, revealing that Andy has been lying to the family about the future of his career and that Ray got the promotion over him. Andy later discovers that Judith has been filming his behavioral issues when Andy takes the camera from Judith after performing a magic trick in front of everybody at the pool party, and he inadvertently outs himself in what he has been doing to everybody at the party when he goes to play back the magic trick, but has to rewind the tape to get to that part of the filming. Unable to afford their new dream house, the Kings hole up at their old house. Appalled, Sheila goes to work, and Joe and Judith go to school. Andy then explores the house with the video camera and discovers that Sheila favors Joe over Judith as a result of postnatal depression she had suffered, and he finds that Joe has a stash of illegal drugs and a video of Joe receiving oral sex from Claire, and a secret shrine to Claire that Judith had built. On camera, Andy admits that he was the one who hurt Ray to try and get the promotion while Ray was incapacitated. That night, Sheila, Judith, and Joe are woken up by a smoke alarm and discover that Andy has locked all the doors and windows. He then reveals everything he had discovered about the dysfunctional family, including Judith's secret infatuation with Claire, inadvertently outing her. Sheila and Joe give Andy an ultimatum. Either they leave or Andy does. An angry Sheila then also reveals that years ago she secretly aborted her third pregnancy because she feared Andy. The next day, Judith returns home from a visit to Claire, with Claire, to discover that her father is about to commit suicide. Despite her embrace, Andy chokes her out before murdering Joe and Sheila. Andy declares he is going to be reunited with his family. And as he stumbles around due to the overdose of pills that he has taken to commit suicide, he hits the camera, causing it to roll in front of Judith's face, which reveals that she is still alive. However, we then hear Andy grunt, and he hits and breaks the camera one final time. And then, as the movie ends, it shows the family having a good time at the beach, and then the credits roll. So in past episodes, I have made it quite clear that I rather despise the whole found footage subgenre of horror movies. But this is the exception. It's rather well done. And while you might be saying, well, Dustin, this doesn't sound this disturbing. Why did it make you say what the fuck after you were done watching it? Well, it's rather disturbing and quite scary to watch Andy slowly lose his grip on reality and go insane due to the stress. And since this is done on a video camera, like a home movie, it kind of puts you right in it like it was real life. You know, not like how most found footage horror movies do it, but this is done pretty authentically. And it's, like I said, it's just really fucking frightening and creepy to slowly see Andy slip into becoming a nutbag. And near the end of the movie, after Andy, what's the word I'm looking for? Suffocates Judith with his body. He looks into the camera, and you can just see the fucking crazy in his eyes, and that's really fucking disturbing. It's a really good shot, and it's a really disturbing shot. If you ever watch this, you'll see what I mean. It's really fucking creepy. But this is one I highly recommend, and like I said before, since you all know my hatred for found footage movies, that's a pretty high recommendation if I'm telling you to watch this. IMDb gives this a 6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes is 65%. Letterboxd a 3.1 out of 5. And I give it a 4.5 out of 5. Next up, we have 2012's Excision.
Dear God, my little sister is slowly dying. And my mom, as I'm sure you know, is a total bitch.
Chew with your mouth closed.
I'm planning on having premarital sex. I'd accept full responsibility for all my actions. But let's face it, he gave me hormones. Can you contract an STD from having sex with a dead person?
Go to your
The movie opens introducing us to Pauline, a disturbed and delusional high school student with aspirations of a career in medicine, who goes to extremes to earn the approval of her controlling mother. Pauline has a younger sister named Grace, who suffers from cystic fibrosis. Pauline has vivid dreams about herself and others being mutilated with excessive amounts of blood, and after each dream wakes panting in an orgasmic state. Pauline decides to lose her virginity to a boy named Adam. Because of her fascination with blood, she arranges their meeting while she is on her period. While having an orgasm, she imagines herself choking Adam and the bed filling with blood. She then asks Adam to go down on her, which he obliged. He then runs to the bathroom, disgusted by the blood, as he was unaware that she was on her period. The next day, during sex education class, Pauline takes a sample of her blood and puts it under a microscope to check for STDs. Later, she sees Adam with his girlfriend, and she tells Adam she doesn't have any STDs and asks his girlfriend if she has any. Pauline then tells him that if the girlfriend doesn't have anything, neither will she. Adam's girlfriend deduces that he was unfaithful and gets all pissed off. Across the street from Pauline is a teenage girl who jumps rope. Pauline invites a girl to jump rope with her, but she finds Pauline weird and refuses. Grace then comes and defends her sister and storms off. Then Adam's now ex-girlfriend and her friend throw toilet paper on Pauline's house and spray paint cunt and whore on it. Pauline, on an angry tirade, then pushes Adam to the ground and slams his ex-girlfriend's face into her locker, resulting in her being expelled from school. While in her room, she overhears her parents say Grace's doctor wants her on the lung transplant list, and then during dinner, Grace has a severe coughing fit, which concerns her parents, and in the morning, Pauline drugs her father with tea and ties him up. She then lures a jump roping girl to the backyard and knocks her out with a chemical. She then drugs Grace after talking to her affectionately and cuts and shaves her own hair. In the garage, Pauline cuts open both girls and commences with her surgery, moving the healthy girl's lungs into her sister and placing the other lungs on ice, then sewing them back up. Pauline's mother then arrives home and sees her husband all tied up. She panics, frantically screaming for Grace, and finds Pauline with the bodies. Pauline explains that it is her first surgery, and although it is messy, it is wonderful. She then urges her mother to take a closer look, who grabs her, screaming hysterically before embracing her. Pauline then at first seems proud, but then begins to sob and starts screaming as well as she realizes what she has done as the movie ends. This movie kind of starts out like a coming-of-age story. Just about your typical American teenage girl trying to find her way and trying to lose her virginity, blah, 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 while being seen as, kind of like the weird kid at school. But then this quickly turns into something even more fucked up and disturbing than their usual coming-of-age story. There's some rather gory, to put it lightly, and some quite disturbing scenes in this fucking movie, especially when Pauline is performing the surgery on Grace and the jump rope girl. It's pretty fucking graphic, to say the least. And it'll definitely put you off your popcorn if you're eating while you're watching this. And it's not like it's tastefully, well, I guess it's kind, well, it's gory, let's put it that way, but it's, and graphic, but it's not as graphic as they could have made it, if that makes any sense, but it's definitely not something you want to watch while you're eating. And this actually has a cast of not that well-known actors, but for what this is, this has some pretty big names in it, like John Waters, Ariel Winter, Roger Bart, Jeremy Sumpter, and Tracy Lords. It's definitely one to watch if you can stomach it. IMDb gave this a 6.1 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 85%, Letterboxd a 3.3 out of 5, and I give it a 4.3 out of 5. Next up, we have 2015's highly disturbing Atroz, aka Atrocious.
Quintanilla. Los investigadores confían que la aparición de una cámara de vídeo que al parecer pertenecía al joven Cristian Quintanilla arroje luz sobre el caso. policía está analizando las más de 37 horas de material grabado.
Hola, soy Cristian, mi hermana Julie. Como ya sabéis, nosotros nos dedicamos a investigar leyendas urbanas. Nuestros padres nos obligan a pasar la Semana Santa en una casa de campo que tenemos en Sitges.
¿Qué os parece?
¡Qué bonito! ¿Te gusta?
No está mal, ¿eh? ¿Y esto que te decía?
¡Qué chungo! ¿Eso también es nuestro?
No sé.
A ver qué hay aquí. Hostia, tiene un candado. No me extraña que se perdiera una niña por aquí en el 1940. Y si te pierdes, que no te pille de noche.
No quiero que andéis por ahí fuera, es bastante peligroso.
Vale, entonces que grabo el caminito con árboles y con flores y el rollo.
He dicho que no quiero que salgáis fuera.
Yo sinceramente no creo que sea el espíritu de una niña. Yo no creo en fantasmas en estas historias.
¿Por qué ladra?
No sé, no se ve nada.
A lo mejor tiene miedo. ¡Tobin!
Joder, puto perro, ¿dónde se ha metido?
Oye, mira bien por dónde estamos caminando, que no quiero que se nos haga de noche otra vez, ¿eh?
This film, like Exhibit A, opens with a notice from the police, but I can't tell you what it says, because even though I do speak a little Spanish, I don't know enough to understand what it's saying. Oh, this is a Spanish language film, by the way, with English subtitles. But anyway, Commissioner Juarez is called to a fatal car accident. The two drivers, Goyo and Gorda, were arrested. Juarez doesn't wait for a forensic investigation and finds a video from the glove compartment of the car. The video shows how the two drivers brutally torture a transvestite to death. Juarez has the two murderers tortured to find out the location of the crime. At the scene of the crime, the officers discover one with another murder and a video cassette showing Goyo's youth. Goyo was abused and humiliated by his parents when they found out that Goyo was gay. Together with his sister Daniela, he kills his parents, but after the murder, he tries to kill his sister too. Juarez then first reveals to Goyo that his partner Gordo has committed suicide. Then he explains that the transvestite was his brother, and also that Daniela is not dead at all. He leads her to the interrogation room and opens her handcuffs. And a bunch of other shit happens that I'm not going to get into because I don't really want to spoil it. But this is a Spanish speaking or a Spanish film that is a splatter film. And I'm going to get into that in a second. But this is another found footage film. But like Exhibit A, it's done very well, so I don't have a problem with it. But when I say this is a splatter film, boy, is it a fucking splatter film. The first half kind of plays off like a snuff film. If you don't know what a snuff film is, because you're too young, go ask your parents. No, wait, on second thought, don't, because I'm sure you'll get fucking grounded. But a snuff film was basically, well, they're widely reported to be real, but they've since been debunked, I guess is the best way to put it, and have kind of become an urban legend. But a snuff film is where, it's a porn film, but it's where the porn actress is being tortured to death. In sexual ways, let's put it that way. In very brutal ways. And it's just There are some really fucking brutal death scenes in this, such as people being tied to posts and left to bleed, or I guess bleed isn't the best word, but gush out their life, and people are set on fire and burned alive quite graphically in fireplaces. It's all just a really fucking graphic movie. And it's not one that I think a lot of people can stomach. Even I had a hard time watching this one. And like I said, I can sit through pretty much anything. Much like most splatter films, this doesn't really have much of a plot. It's just gore after gore after gore for gore's sake. So if that's not your thing, this is one I'd highly recommend you avoid. But for gore hounds, it's a wet dream. It's all way over the top and extreme, just to be over the top and extreme. But there are a few pretty fucking creepy scenes in this. Like I said, I'm not going to spoil it if you really do want to try to track this down and watch it. I believe it's on some streaming sites. But if you do watch it, like I said, just be warned, it's very fucking graphic. IMDb gave this a 5.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a surprising 79%. Letterboxd a 2.6 out of 5. And I give it a 2.8 out of 5. Next up, we have 2018's The House That Jack Built.
Oh, this is a fine little house, Jack.
Are you allowed to speak along the way? I was thinking there might be rules.
Let me put it this way. Very few make it all the way without uttering a word. But do carry on merrily. Just don't believe you're going to tell me something I haven't heard before.
Maybe a mistake.
What was maybe a mistake?
Me getting in this car with you. You might as well be a serial killer. Sorry, but you do kind of look like one.
We commit in our fiction are those inner desires which we cannot commit in our controlled civilization. So they are expressed instead through our art. I don't agree. I believe heaven and hell are one and the same. The soul belongs to heaven and the body to hell. Think about all the things I've done in my life without in any way resulting in punishment.
Jack, a failed architect in 1980s Washington State, tells how he became a serial killer to Virgil, whom he refers to as Virge, as Virge leads Jack through the nine circles of hell. Each of Jack's crimes depicted through flashbacks feature commentary from both Jack and Virge. In the first incident, Jack encounters an abrasive woman on a rural road who needs him to fix her broken jack to repair a flat tire. He agrees to take her to a local blacksmith to repair it. On the way, she says he looks like a serial killer and insults him. When they return, the jack breaks again, and the woman requests that Jack return her to the blacksmith. On the second trip, she recants her comments, stating that he is too much of a wimp to kill anyone. Offended by this, Jack bludgeons her with a tire jack. He then stores her body in an industrial freezer inside a factory building, which he purchases from a pizzeria. In the second incident, Jack cons his way into the home of a widow, Claire, then strangles and stabs her. After cleaning up, he puts her body in the back of his car, instead of leaving, his obsessive-compulsive disorder compels him to return to re-clean the crime scene multiple times, nearly resulting in him being caught when a suspicious police officer stops by. Jack manages to outwit the officer by pretending to be an acquaintance of Claire, and he then ties Claire's body to the back of the van in a panic and drives off, dragging her body behind and creating a blood trail. It starts raining, washing away the trail, and Jack takes this as divine intervention, believing God is on his side. Jack then puts her corpse in the industrial freezer, and he declares himself Mr. Sophistication and begins signing anonymous letters to the media with this moniker. He also develops a fetish for photographing his victims' corpses and begins taking greater risks as his OCD diminishes, such as impulsively hitting an old woman with his van. In the third incident, Jack brings his girlfriend and her two sons, Grumpy and George, on a hunting trip. He then kills both sons with a rifle before forcing the woman to have a picnic with their corpses. He then ultimately kills her too, and then Jack then waits for rigor mortis to set in on Grumpy's corpse and proceeds to fashion it into a waving sculpture with a grisly smile. In the fourth incident, Jack is in a dysfunctional relationship with Jacqueline, whom he psychologically and verbally abuses and derisively nicknames Simple. When he drunkenly confesses to her that he has killed 60 people, she doesn't believe him, and after he marks red circles around her breast with a marker, she becomes frightened and approaches a policeman, but he dismisses her as drunk. In her apartment, Jackie binds her before cutting off her tits with a knife, and he pins one of the breasts to the policeman's car and fashions the other into a wallet. In the fifth and final incident, Jack has detained 6 men in his freezer, intending to kill all of them with a single bullet. Upon realizing his ammunition has been mislabeled, he leaves and, insults the gun shop owner before visiting a friend, SP. SP then phones a police officer, and Jack stabs SP through the throat. He waits for the police, then kills the officer. He then returns to his freezer, and needing more space to focus the scope of his rifle, unseals a closed door inside, revealing a second chamber. Inside, he meets Verge, who reveals he has been observing Jack throughout his life and reminds him that he has never built the home he intended to, as Jack has made several attempts to build his perfect house between his murders. In the freezer, Jack arranges the frozen corpses he has collected over the years in the shape of a house, and as the police break in, Jack enters his quote-unquote house and follows Verge into a hole in the floor, entering hell. The two reach a pit leading to the ninth circle and center of hell. In the process of descending into hell, footage is shown about the Kola super deep borehole in which, according to legend, human cries from the underworld, which Verge mentions, were heard. A broken bridge spans the pit, and Jack notices a stairway on the other side of the bridge, which Verge says leads the way out of hell. Jack then attempts to scale a rock wall to access the staircase against Verge's advice, and falls into the abyss below as the movie ends. Directed by Lars von Trier, who has some really fucked up ideas, as we'll see in another movie that I will talk about in this episode later on. This is definitely not one you want to watch with the fucking kids. I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. I guess the best way to put it is it's very, very brutal to the extreme. And it features extremely gory and graphic bludgeonings, strangling, stabbings, torture, child murder, and manipulation of dead bodies. And it's all done very mean-spirited, especially when Jack kills the two kids, who's, I can only remember the name of one, Grumpy. And when he stages a picnic with the mother and the corpses of her two sons. It's like I said, it's all done very mean-spirited. Every kill in this movie is. And that makes it kind of hard to watch. Not just how graphic the murders are, but just, once again, the whole mean-spiritedness that is found throughout this entire movie. It's very dark, to say the least. And it's kind of hard to stomach, especially if you've never seen it before. So if you're going to, I mean, it's good, but if you're going to watch it, take heed to my warnings about it. It's can be a very difficult watch. IMDb gave this a 6.8 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 60%. Letterboxd a 3.2 out of 5. And I give it a 4 out of 5. Next up, we have the 1986 remake of The Fly.
I think you're making a mistake. I think you really want to talk to me.
Sorry, I have 3 other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yep, they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
If you saw how scared and angry and desperate he is.
I'm sure Typhoid Mary was a very nice person, too, when you saw her socially.
No!
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
Wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no. A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone. Don't go back to it.
Could be contagious.
I'm afraid.
Don't be afraid.
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
The brilliant but eccentric scientist Seth Brundle meets science journalist Veronica Ronnie Quaife at a meet-the-press event held by Bartok Science Industries, the company funding his work. He takes her back to the laboratory of his warehouse home and asks her to exclusively document his invention, two pods that can teleport objects between them. While the telepods can transport inanimate objects perfectly, they are unable to teleport live tissue, as demonstrated when a baboon is turned inside out after being teleported. As they experiment with the invention, Seth and Ronnie begin to form a relationship. Using two stakes, one a control and one teleported, Seth discovers that the machine is creating a synthetic version of biological material rather than the object itself. He reprograms the system to understand the makeup of living tissue and successfully teleports a second baboon. Ronnie then departs before they can celebrate, and Seth worries that she is rekindling her relationship with her editor, Stathis Borens. She actually left to confront Stathis about a veiled threat, spurred by his jealousy of Seth, to publish the telepod story without her consent. While drunk, Seth teleports himself alone, unaware that a housefly had entered the transmitter pod with him. He then emerges from the receiving pod, seemingly normal. After Seth and Ronnie reconcile, Seth exhibits sugar cravings, as well as increased strength, agility, stamina, and sexual potency, which he believes resulted from the teleportation purifying his body. When Ronnie becomes concerned about Seth's deteriorating sanity and both the strange bristly hairs growing from a wound on his back and developing sores on his face, Seth becomes aggressive, insisting that the process is beneficial. He tries to force Ronnie to undergo teleportation, but she refuses, and Seth goes to a bar and partakes in an arm wrestling match, leaving his opponent with a compound fracture. He then brings a woman named Tani back to the warehouse where they have sex, after which Seth tries to coerce her into teleporting. Ronnie then intervenes, and Seth throws her out. When his fingernails begin falling off, he realizes that something is indeed wrong. He then checks his computer's records and discovers that the telepods confuse the two life forms, fusing him with the fly at the molecular genetic level. Seth then continues to deteriorate, losing body parts along with his human appearance. After several weeks, he reconnects with Ronnie and reveals he is a hybrid of human and insect, which he has nicknamed Brundlefly. He has also begun vomiting digestive enzymes onto his food before eating and is able to cling to walls and ceilings. He is even losing his human mentality in favor of uncontrollable primitive impulses. Seth then installs a fusion program into the telepod computer, planning to dilute the fly genes in his body with human DNA. Ronnie then discovers she is pregnant with Seth's baby and has a nightmare of giving birth to a giant maggot. She demands that Seth persuade a doctor to perform an abortion in the middle of the night, but Seth, overhearing Ronnie's fears, abducts her before the procedure can take place and begs her to carry the child to term, since it may be the last remnant of his humanity. Stathis then breaks into Seth's lab with a shotgun, but Seth disables him using his corrosive vomit to destroy Stathis' hand and foot, stopping just short of vomiting acid onto his face when Ronnie screams at him to stop. Seth then reveals his final plan to Ronnie. He will use the telepods to fuse the two of them, along with the unborn child, into a single entity to become the ultimate family. After this, she accidentally tears off his jaw in a struggle, which triggers his final transformation, shedding his decaying flesh to become a monstrous insectoid human creature. Seth traps Ronnie in the first telepod and puts himself in the other, and begins a countdown. A weakened Stathis recovers his shotgun and severs the cables connecting Ronnie's telepod to his computer. Seth breaks halfway out of his own pod, but the fusion process activates. Gruesomely transfusing him with a chunk of the telepod, Seth then crawls to Ronnie and places the end of the shotgun to his head, silently begging her to end his suffering. She tearfully fires, killing him instantly, and falls to her knees in despair as the movie ends. A remake of the classic horror movie of the same name from the 1950s, starring Vincent Price. This is another one that you definitely should not watch while eating. It's probably one of the most disgusting body horror films I have ever seen in my fucking life, which is no surprise since David Cronenberg directed this. If you don't know who he is, go look up some of his other movies. Most of them are body horror, and the majority of them are pretty fucking gross. But this one is probably the grossest. And like I said, it's definitely one not to watch while you eat. You will not be able to finish your meal. There was a sequel to this made in 1989, but it's pretty lame and isn't anything like this one. IMDb gave this a 7.6 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 93%, Letterboxd a 4 out of 5, and I give it a 5 out of 5. I was going to talk about another Lars von Trier movie, Antichrist, but I believe I already talked about it back in season 2, maybe season 3, I don't fucking remember. So I'm not going to rehash it now, but I'll tell you, it's a pretty fucking weird movie, and it opens with a really graphic death of a young child, which is really quite disturbing when you watch it. But Lars von Trier, once again the director of this, said he wrote this when he was going through a bout of severe depression, And it definitely shows in this. It's a really, really dark movie. Not a whole lot of it makes any sense. There's a bunch of weird shit that goes on in it, including a talking fox. And some really graphic sex. And I guess it's okay for what it is. It's more arty than scary, I guess is the best way to put it. And it's overly long. But, like I said, the opening scene alone makes it really disturbing. And it's a quite depressing movie. So if you see, and it's available, I believe it's on Netflix every now and then, and on other streaming sites as well. So if you feel like being depressed, that's definitely one to watch. But don't say I didn't warn you. And that leads us into 1992's Man Bites Dog.
That is me, Remy. I'm a filmmaker, and I'm making a film about Ben, a man of many talents. He was a connoisseur of fine foods. A first-rate poet.
Avec la mer du Nord.
A philosopher. And a composer. But what fascinated me most about Ben was the intensity he brought to his work. Ben was a killer. An extremely clever and creative killer. Almost to the point of genius. He could hit a moving target, sight unseen, and strike at a moment's notice. He was a consummate professional.
Bingo!
He was quite a guy. So, when he asked us to join in the fun, we felt honored. I mean, he was the star of our movie, and who were we to say no? Afterwards, we all celebrated into the night. And what a party it was, for a short while at least, until things got way out of hand. Man Bites Dog. It's a comedy about a serial killer that goes straight for the jugular. But who ever thought it would be banned in countries like Sweden and Australia? After all, we were awarded the International Critics Prize at Cannes. I mean, even in Montreal, they thought it was a smash. And when we got to L.A., they told us it was provocative and powerful. Maybe even the best film released this year.
Ben is witty and charismatic, but he is also narcissistic and an easily enraged serial killer who invites a film crew along on his sadistic adventures, recording them for a fly-on-the-wall documentary. Ben takes them to meet his family and friends while boasting of murdering many people at random and dumping their bodies in canals and quarries. The viewer, we then witness these grisly killings in very graphic detail. Ben ventures into apartment buildings, explaining how it is more cost-effective to attack old people than young couples because the elderly have more cash at home and are easier to kill. In the following scene, he screams wildly at an elderly lady, causing her to have a heart attack, and as she lays dying, he casually remarks that this method saved him a bullet. Ben then continues his candid explanations and rampage, shooting, strangling, and beating to death anyone who comes his way, women, illegal immigrants, and postmen, who are his favorite targets. He enjoys killing postmen at the start of the month because they tend to have parcels with money and other goods that he can steal, and he enjoys killing women because they don't fight back, and he also enjoys killing immigrants because he's a total racist. He jokes about having murdered two Muslims and making sure to entomb their bodies in a wall that faces Mecca, and amuses himself by checking out the genitals of a black security guard after he shot the man in the head. The camera crew becomes more and more involved in the murders, starting out as silent accomplices but gradually assisting Ben in his killings. When Ben invades a home and kills an entire family, they help him hold down a young boy and smother him with a pillow, all the while keeping up a casual conversation. During filming, two of Ben's crew are killed. Their deaths are later called occupational hazards by a crew member and offhandedly mourned. At the abandoned building that Ben uses for a hideout, the crew encounters two Italian criminals also hiding out in the building. Ben kills the Italians before discovering that they were actually also being filmed by a competing documentary camera crew. And so Ben and his camera crew have fun taking turns as they shoot the rival crew members to death and record the whole thing. While fooling around with the crew, Ben takes a couple having sex hostage in their own home, holding the man at gunpoint while he and the crew gang rape the woman. The following morning, the camera dispassionately records the aftermath. The woman has been butchered with a knife, her entrails spilling out, while the husband has had his throat cut. Later, Ben's girlfriend and family receive death threats from the brother of one of the Italian criminals who Ben had killed earlier, and Ben's violence becomes more and more random until he kills an acquaintance in front of his girlfriend and friends during a birthday dinner. Splattered with blood, they act as though nothing horrible has happened, continuing to offer Ben gifts, and the film crew disposes of the body for Ben. After a victim flees before he can be killed, Ben is arrested, but he escapes. At this point, someone, presumably the brother of the dead Italians, along with other members of the two dead Italians' criminal organization, start taking revenge on Ben and his family. Ben discovers that his girlfriend Valerie has been killed. She had been murdered in a particularly humiliating manner, with her flute inserted up her ass. He later finds that his parents met the same fate, his mother, who owns a shop and is not a musician, being sodomized with the end of a broomstick. This prompts Ben to decide that he must leave. He meets the camera crew to say farewell, but in the middle of reciting a poem, he is abruptly shot dead by an off-camera gunman. The camera crew is then picked off one by one, and then after the camera falls, it keeps running, and the film ends with the death of the fleeing second crew member. This movie, although it was filmed in 1992, is shot all in black and white, which makes a lot of sense when it all comes down to it, because this is an extremely dark movie, and it is extremely brutal, and it never lets up on the brutality, and it basically just grabs you by the throat and refuses to let go. It's fairly graphic, especially back for the time when this was made. And it caused a lot of controversy back then. It's an entertaining watch, but it, like I said, it is fairly graphic. And the black and white just accentuates the brutality of everything that's being done to these people. You can also tell that, Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon took a lot of inspiration from this movie, because that movie also deals, you know, with this killer hiring a camera crew to follow him around while he's doing his rounds. IMDb gave this a 7.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, another surprising 74%. Letterboxd, a 3.7 out of 5, and I give it a 3.5 out of 5. And we're going to wrap this up with some honorable mentions. They're honorable mentions because I've mentioned them in past episodes, and if you want to know more about them, go back and search, because I really don't know what season to tell you that they're in. But honorable mentions go to Dead Alive, Meet the Feebles, Bad Taste, Teeth, Martyrs, Inside, and Frontiers, and Slither as well. And that's it for this episode. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you guys at the beginning of August.